The Gambling Files Podcast, the podcast that's sponsored by Sporting Tech. They're lovely. Hello, you're listening to the Gambling Files Podcast. We've been away. Hello, Fintan.
Sorry, who's this?
You're a twat.
What I love is, and we're going to have to get into like why you've been away, but while I was away, the podcast went on seamlessly and continued, despite much mocking of me being in Australia for an extended period of time. You take a little bit of time off and everything falls to shit. So I think we've finally discovered the true balance of power in the relationship, John. I love it.
I was incapacitated, though.
I know you were. Are you okay?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, kind of.
What happened?
I mean, yeah, I am.
Yeah.
I did put a post on LinkedIn actually saying that I was off with concussion. So what was it about? It was over a month ago now, wasn't it? It was about 5 weeks ago. Christ. I appreciate you know most of this, Fintan. I was at home on a weekend. I was outside with my next door neighbor, Lynn. And I was helping her empty a toolbox, not a euphemism. And I stood up and I fainted and I went over backwards. And the first part of me that connected with the floor was the back of my head on some tarmac. And I was knocked out for quite a long time. 4 or 5 minutes, apparently, and a lot of blood. But it was the weekend, so my kids were there. So they weren't best pleased.
Of course. It's been terrifying for them.
Well, they, oldest and youngest, Annie and Al, were inside, so they didn't know anything about it. Middle, Joe, was over the road with his friend Jackson in their house. And apparently, I was told later, they were just laughing and giggling and doing like seven-year-old things. And then Joe just stopped and started screaming because he'd looked out the window and seen me in a pool of blood.
Oh, Christ.
And that alerted Jackson's parents. Because, of course, Lynn, you wouldn't know this. Lynn is one of my lovely neighbors, not the asshole neighbors. Lynn's quite slight, you know, there's nothing to it really. And she's quite old. So, I mean, she couldn't have moved me or anything. But Jackson's folks came out to help. And rather brilliantly, Jackson's older sister, whose name is Chloe. Chloe, completely, she wasn't asked to do this by anybody. She, I think Chloe's about 14 or 15. She came straight out of their house and walked over the road and went straight into my house to go be with the kids.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is pretty amazing.
That's some switched on thinking that. That's really good.
Yeah. And she didn't tell Al and Annie what had happened. So they were still clueless. She was just keeping them occupied. What's quite funny is later on, another neighbor, Karen, went in there and said, right, so your dad's okay, don't worry. And they're like, what?
What? Jesus Christ.
What do you mean? Apparently Chloe's there like, oh, God. So Fern came over, Jackson's mum. Jackson's mum, my neighbour, my opposite neighbour, she phoned Fern, and Fern came over. And Fern phoned our mate Gareth. Gareth came over to stay with the kids. And Fern took me to hospital because they'd phoned an ambulance because obviously I had been unconscious for a while. Mm. The ambulance wait was 4 to 6 hours.
Christ.
Despite a pretty significant loss of consciousness and me having young children with me. So there must have been something pretty serious going on somewhere. that the ambulance service in our area is hopelessly overstretched, both in Wales, in Herefordshire and in Shropshire. It's an absolute joke. Philip Dunn, if you're anybody that works for you is listening, you're a fucking shame. You're a bag of bollocks. Sorry, that's the MP for South Shropshire, who was the health minister. And while he was health minister, they closed all of the midwife-led maternity units in the county, all of them, and made people, if you wanted to have a baby and you were likely to have any complications, you had to go to Telford and Wrekin, which would be fine. But Telford and Wrekin is the hospital that's just been the at the heart of an inquiry about unnecessary infant deaths. And there were tens of babies dying every year because of poor practices at the hospital that you were made to go to. So anyway, digressed a little bit there. Philip Dunn, you big fucking twat. So I went to the hospital. I had a CT scan, bloods, all that jazz. They said, go on, fuck off. You're fine, apart from that massive lump on the back of your head. But I had concussion, so I had had to have a couple of weeks off work. And then we had Vegas, G2E.
Mm.
So I went and did that. That was good.
How did that go?
Yeah, it was all right. It was like, it's good. I mean, it's just really odd to be in a room full of people that you kind of know really well. Well, no, not even that you kind of know really. People that you've known for years and years. But, we usually see each other at these things 3-4 times a year. And so not seeing these people for 4 years, I got hugged a lot. That was pretty cool.
That's nice.
But I also think that may have led to what happened the week after.
Syphilis.
So I come back from Vegas, and I live a long, long way from London, and we'd flown out of Heathrow. So I got back, came back via JFK, and I got back sort of Friday evening. And I drove back, and it's about a 3-hour drive. And as I was getting closer to home, I was starting to feel really quite rough and not great. And yeah, got quite close to home, and I'm thinking, oh, not feeling good at all now. By the time I got back, apart from the fact that it was blowing an absolute gale, I mean, it was really kicking up a storm, and it was peeing down with rain. And I go to get in the house, and I'm shivering so badly, I can't even get the key in the door. But luckily it was peeing down. I was not in a good way. But I got in the house, and realized I was probably a bit poorly. Woke up the next morning, did a COVID test, which turned up positive. So came back from Vegas with COVID, which, God, be honest, COVID really floored me for a good 4 days. The first 2-3 days were absolutely shocking. I tested positive for 6 days, I think. I think I have my 6 or 7 days. Can't remember if I tested negative on the Thursday or the Friday. And because all around where I live is generally really, really old people, I stayed very much in the house and didn't go out. And partly because I felt really shit as well. So there was that. And the other thing about the COVID thing was, so, I mean, that kind of wiped me out for the best part of a week. But the fatigue afterwards was amazing. I mean, yeah. I'm not claiming like any kind of long COVID thing because, long COVID sounds awful. But I was knackered. It took my napping game to a new level. So here's a great example, right? I went to visit Fern and the kids, right? And the cat was really pleased to see me, Bernard Pickle. He's a mighty, mighty cat.
It's a great name.
Bernard, if you're listening. So I sat down to say hello to my cat. And Bernard, he's such an affectionate cat. And he came and he sort of sat on my lap. And I was sitting on Fern's kitchen floor. And Bernard Pickle's on my lap doing cat stuff. And I was just sitting, you know, sitting down on my ass with my legs straight out in front of me. You know, the way that people would usually sit with their hands on the floor behind them, that kind of position.
So you know, us regular folks with tight hamstrings, how we'd sit versus how you sit, like a toddler.
Yeah, so I was just sitting straight up. I didn't have my hands on the floor because, you know, I've got stomach muscles and things. And so I was sitting there, I was just fussing the cat, and Fern went out to do something. And I fell asleep. I fell asleep sitting there like that, stroking the cat. It wasn't just I must be really tired. I slept for 40 minutes.
Wow.
In that position, just slumped over. Yeah, my napping game is like, it's up here somewhere. There's like, I'm the Kobe Bryant of napping now. I met some podcast fans while we were away.
Fantastic.
And I met people who kind of, it's like, I've been doing Casino International 17 years, right? And I met one chap, two blokes I met, and one of them I was like, you're the bloke from wherever he was from. It's nice to meet you. I'm John. And he was like, oh, where are you from, John? And his colleague just said, the Gambling Files podcast. And I'm like, I could say Casino International magazine, but I'm not going to. There was that. But also, I was asked by people, what's Fintan really like?
Is he really a twat? Yes, he is.
I just said, well, look, he's Irish, so he's quite an angry person.
It's just trying to keep him sober is the trick.
Yeah. And the only way to do that is with methadone. Just make sure he's so wasted he can't pick the drink up.
He's got demons. He's got demons.
No, but people were very, very complimentary about the podcast. One chap I was talking to was like, so you must script it before you start. No, I'm serious.
Oh, that's
true. And he couldn't believe that we don't script it.
That's very smart.
Of course we don't fucking script. I mean, really, listen to some episodes again.
We're mavericks.
We definitely don't. You can't. We just light the touch paper and run.
Jesus. That's nice. It's nice to get, nice to get compliments.
Yeah, I had such lovely feedback while we were away. So that was cool. And the show was pretty good. I guess the thing I like about G2E is I think they've kind of learned that all the gimmicky stuff just, it's a bit fucking boring.
What's the gimmick?
They just seem to focus on, well, they don't really do it. They just put on a conference, which seems pretty decent. Mm. Friend of the podcast, Dr. Michael Auer, was there. He was on a panel for the conference. And we haven't had her on yet, but I met Tammy Barlow from Rush Street Interactive. Hopefully she's going to be coming on as a guest.
Oh, fantastic. It's a good brand. I like them.
I've been trying to get Tammy on for ages, but I mean, she's just been really busy because I think she's only been at Rush Street for a year or so. So there was that, you know, bedding in and all that stuff. Well, and she's a busy gaming executive.
Yeah, of course.
She hasn't got the free time on her hands that you and I have got. Well, you.
I'm glad you think I've got loads of free time.
I know you have loads of free time. What have you been up to?
Just sitting here, staring at the screen, waiting for John to email me back. what have I been doing?
Fair.
I've been spending a lot of time sitting beside swimming pools. So my son has made this...
with a camera.
No, Jesus. My son's made this swim racing team, race swimming. I don't know what you call it in English. So it's a very prestigious kind of Amsterdam one that's had a bunch of Olympic swimmers come through it over the years. But he's swimming 5 times a week now. And none of the swimming pools are kind of like commuting distance for him. So it's all like dad taxi type stuff. So I've just instantly lost like 10 hours of my week, just vanished up in smoke.
Well, how old is
he? He's 10.
So it's probably the cleanest he's ever been.
No, because you just smell of fucking chlorine. Like, it's just horrible. Like, you need to, you know, just trying to get him to wash his hair every night kind of thing. So I've been doing a lot of sitting by the pool, watching him swim. So that's been interesting. What else have I done? It's about it. It was just been working, really. Just head down, getting the job done. Nothing exciting. I deliberately avoided all the, because there was a raft of conferences like back to back. So there was Barcelona, Malta, G2E. I think there's Malta. I think there's another Sigma thing now. Like, it's just endless conferences.
We've very quickly gone back to too many live events.
It's just, you physically can't attend them all. Like, it's impossible. So I think there needs to be a bit of a rationalization there or something.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at sort of online event organization with my new role with the Gaming Boardroom, which is, I previously not mentioned anywhere ever.
I was going to say, exclusive.
But part
world
of
exclusive.
That is,
look at this.
It is a world exclusive. But part of that is just looking at that and thinking, well, you're asking an awful lot out of people.
But it's there's a few things, right? So straight up, there's the cost. So, you know, flying right now is a bit of a nightmare because I'm in Amsterdam, so Schiphol is a bit of a mess depending on what day you arrive at. And good luck if you're checking in bags, like, you're never going to see that again. But there's the cost of flights, which aren't cheap anymore. There's hotel costs. Then there's your kind of just, you know, you're eating out and doing whatever for the couple of days. But then I like, as I've gotten older, like, my ability to recover, because, you know, you do meetings all day and then it's like drinks and dinner and stuff at nighttime. So you're kind of doing a full on day. Do that for 2 or 3 days, plus, you know, you're tired from traveling and probably getting up early to grab a flight. And you come back wrecked. So it's been it takes me like 2 weeks to recover from a conference. And that's without catching COVID.
I stopped doing the whole. Well, I've stopped it as much as I can, doing drinks, dinner, etc. in the evenings, because it's just exhausting.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean,
I just made a thing of, okay, I'm just not going to do any of them. I'm just going to swerve them all. I'll probably do ice next year, and that's basically it.
I've always said that if you only do one expo, it's got to be ice.
Yeah, and I think based on what I saw on social media and stuff, I think, because I did my first G2E in 2019, and it wasn't really, I think there's a lot more online folks there this year than there has been the last time I was there.
Yeah, but still hard.
Yeah, but it seemed a bit more, there seemed to be a bit more going on, so I think there'd be more of a reason to go. But then you kind of like, well, actually I can just meet all these people in London at ICE, so it's not actually that big a deal.
Yeah, I knew a dude who, he went to ICE to meet all the people from the Native American gambling
companies.
That
makes perfect sense. I think if you're doing any sort of B2B sales, you need to be there. And
but he said if he goes to what was then called NIGA, now it's Iger, I think. You know, he won't get any time with them because everybody's there for them.
Sure.
Whereas at ICE, they're just walking around and nobody's bothering them, kind of thing. So he was loving it.
I also think, like, you'll get the thing about it as well is, like, you get a lot of people booking meetings just to look busy and stuff like that. So there's a lot of bullshit stuff as well. And I'd rather just book a 40-minute Zoom call, not during a conference, and you'll get as much done with that and that. So I think there's pluses and minuses. So I'm an old grumpy man. I think that's what it really is. I'm sure all the kids love it. smashing the expense accounts and having a great crack. But yeah, I just decided not to do it. And then, you know, like you said, like you got COVID, like everyone's acting like COVID doesn't exist anymore, but a new variant and stuff. And I'm like, I'll just skip this winter and start again next year.
Mm, especially with your weak immune system.
I really touched a nerve with that one, didn't I? But then I got wiped out by the, I got a booster shot the other day, 2 weeks ago. And I was testing negative for COVID. I did have a bit of a head cold or something. I was testing negative, but, and I was kind of, you're technically not meant to do it if you've got anything wrong with you, but I thought I'd be all right. But then it wiped me out. So normally I get a huge reaction to the booster. So it's like 24 hours of really bad flu symptoms. So I had that, but then I've just been like just dead when it comes to energy for the last week. And today's my first day feeling anyway, sort of normal. So yeah, and that was just from the booster shot. So God knows if I actually caught COVID.
Yeah, you could die. I mean, I just bounced back, but yeah. You could die.
Oh dear. Yeah.
So this episode, right, of the podcast, we recorded this quite a while ago.
Did we?
We did, okay. Yeah. This is the episode with
where are we on the
with Lee?
Where are we in the space-time continuum? I can't tell.
This is the episode we recorded with Lee from Future Anthem.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
Which I hadn't edited it before I brained myself. Yeah. Actually, do you know what? The braining myself, that goes on. I went to the doctors last week because I had to have an ECG and more blood done. Because I'm like, do you know what? I think it might be, because there's a history of like, you know, heart disease and stuff in the family. So I sort of said, you know, I'd quite like to just make sure I'm not going to die soon. Because, you know, I like my kids. They're very nice. Hello, kids. So I've got a follow-up actually next week with the doctor. So I'm a little bit excited.
No, look, I think it's something men need to do more in general. Like women, I think, in general, are very good at going to doctors. And I think men are ridiculously bad at going to the doctor. Like, since I've moved to Amsterdam, I've never been to see the GP.
But I think it's tied into the concept of masculinity and stoicism as a part of that. This, you know, you just got to shrug things off and carry on, as opposed to going,
I should probably get that lump checked out.
Well, exactly.
No, I agree.
You know, what could be more important than that? You know, if it turns out to be something bad, nothing.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a bit of head burying in sand as well. But, yeah, I think there's a degree of stoicism. And it's tricky being male, I think, sometimes. Because most of us are shit at it. But the stoicism, I mean, obviously that's not just a male thing. A lot of people, yeah, you know, particularly my parents' generation, were relentlessly stoic, and it doesn't really do you any favors in the long run.
No, it doesn't.
Any.
It doesn't.
Have a good cry. Feel shit. Take a couple of days off. Go see the doctor. Fundamentally, I think you can sum most things up with just don't be a twat.
It's the no dickhead rule. That's it. That's all you got to do. No dickheads.
Have you got a name for it?
Yeah, no dickheads. It's the no dickhead rule.
Well, that's it. Just no dickheads.
The no dickhead rule. Super easy. It works in family life. It works in office life. It works everywhere. Just no dickheads.
Oh, hang on though. I might have a different name for that. Oh no, I can't say it. Okay. It's the forbidden word.
Not the forbidden.
But I think it might be a similar rule. But as I have long said, and it's, you know, the way that I sort of do business is I like to do things that I enjoy with people that I like. because life is quite simply too short to be working with people that you think are assholes.
It's exactly that. Now, obviously, you know, sometimes you've got no choice and you've got to do whatever, but the best way it was ever explained to me is, imagine there's a swimming pool and it's a beautiful swimming pool and it's, you know, nice and big and you can do great swimming in it. And then one person decides to take a dump in the swimming pool. And it's only a little dump. It's only a little turd kind of floating along. But that one little turd has just completely ruined that gorgeous swimming pool. And yeah, just, you know, it's just got to avoid the turds and not letting anybody take a dump in your swimming pool.
Actually, just before we get into the interview mm-hmm. with Lee, have you read any good books?
I have. Let me get the name. Hang on a sec. I'm reading a really interesting book right now. Hang on a sec. Oh, let me get my phone away from the microphone. Where's my Kindle?
I'm not going to trim this or
anything. No, that's fine. It's called Dead in the Water. And it's by Michael. What's his name? Hang on a sec. By Michael Campbell. And what it does is it follows a ship, like a container ship. And it tells mm-hmm. the story. I love industry biographies. And so it tells the story of the shipping industry by following one container ship that gets hijacked by pirates.
Wow.
Off the coast of... what's the ones?
Somalia?
What's the one Saudi? Yemen? Off the coast of Yemen.
Okay.
Or wherever Saudi Arabia's blowing up right now. And yeah, it's fascinating. So, you know, you get the kind of like the really weird ownership structures, like why everything's flagged through Panama, Lloyd's of London for like all the insurance stuff, all the hostage negotiation type guys that kick in, the salvage companies, the assessors. And so it's just, and it's based on a true story. Yeah, super interesting. I'm really enjoying that right now.
I read a fabulous article recently. I can't remember for the life of me where it was, but it was about how the shipping industry is directly affecting the cost of living and what a massive role it's playing in it. It was amazing. And it's to do with, the cost of containers, the turnover of containers, etc. It's just really spectacular.
There's a really good book called The Box, and it's about the history of shipping containers. So it's all about the guy who invented shipping containers and made it a thing, and then how it completely changed shipping, and then the impact on like just making it much cheaper to ship stuff around the world. So just by standardizing that shipping container, he completely changed the nature of, basically changed the world. Because everything we buy either comes in a shipping container or in an airplane, effectively. So there's a really good book on that as well. But yeah, I love like biographies about like that shipping container one was really good. I read one about the, I can't remember what it's called, but one about like the diamond industry. And so I love kind of just learning more about different industries. It's just super interesting. I'm a bit of a nerd. So.
As listeners will no doubt already know.
I don't hide it. I'm not embarrassed.
I like a good, I mean, this isn't like a thing that I necessarily go out to find, but you know, you can get a good sort of historical kind of biography probably. Yeah. You probably say it's a good, is it a biography? A biography of an event, I suppose. So I read a fantastic book, and I really did enjoy it, about the quest to break the 4-minute mile.
Oh, fantastic.
And it followed the three runners. See if I can remember their names. I think the Australian was John Landy, Roger Bannister from the UK, and I can't remember the American chap's name. But any one of them,
because they were all battling it out at the time, right? That was the thing. That's what gets missed in the story about Bannister And it's like, oh, and then he did it. Yeah. And everybody knew it could be done. But actually, they were all, any of them could have done it. Any of those three guys could have, were so close.
Well, he did it. And then the next guy took like about a second and a half off his record about weeks later.
Exactly.
It was, yeah, but it was really nicely written by a guy called Neil Bascom. It was really nicely written. I mean, you think, I think probably Seabiscuit is kind of the gold standard for that kind of book. Because it's just a terrific and really well put together book. But I think like a good historical biography, I think the gold standard overall for me, have you ever read In the Heart of the Sea by Nathaniel Philbrick? No. Not made up name,
no,
amazing.
No, I haven't.
It's a fantastic book. This guy, I probably told you about it before, and if I haven't, really sorry. It's about the incident with the sperm whale attack that directly inspired Herman Melville to write Moby Dick.
Okay.
Now, Melville wasn't involved in the incident, but he was a whaler around Nantucket a couple of decades later, heard the story. It's like, oh, well, that sounds shit. And it happened to, yeah, a whaling ship out of Nantucket. And this guy, Nathaniel Philbrick, is the director, if I remember correctly, of the Whaling Museum in Nantucket. So this guy knows his stuff. And, yeah, it's just, he's put this book together from largely from three accounts. So one of the accounts is like a cabin boy. One of them is the captain's. So you've got this wonderful cross there. Plus his own knowledge of the time, which is probably pretty much unequaled. It's a tremendous read. It really is a terrific book. He also did a biography of the Mayflower.
Okay, that's interesting.
Which I bought, but I haven't read yet. I did spend some time in Harwich in the UK because, of course, everybody associates the Mayflower with sailing from Plymouth, but the boat actually originated in Harwich. If you walk around Harwich, which is a tiny little town on the Essex coast, if you walk around Harwich, there's blue plaques everywhere denoting, you know, ship's chandlery or whatever, because it's still, despite the ship technically not sailing from there, it started there and its crew was there. Etc. Sorry, totally got sidetracked.
No, look, I talk about books all day. That's cool.
I've just started reading the Anthony Kiedis autobiography.
Oh yeah, I read that. That's a really good book. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I mean, he takes a lot of drugs,
a lot of heroin. He's done all the heroin.
He really has. I'm surprised there were any other heroin addicts around at the time because he had it all.
And he's still alive. It's amazing.
Yeah, that is, shows, that is
which I think is a public service announcement. If you're going to do heroin, get the good stuff.
Have you ever seen the Chili Peppers live? So for those not in the know, Anthony Kiedis is a singer from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, probably the principal songwriter as well. I'm not a huge fan of the Chili Peppers, not anymore. But I saw them live in probably 1991, back when they were purported to be the best live band in the world. And I saw them in a little venue in Birmingham called the Hummingbird, which had about, I think it was about 1,100 capacity. And you had three bands on the bill. And they'd not long released Blood Sugar Sex Magik, which was the album that made them huge. Under the Bridge hadn't been released yet, which was the song that went stratospheric. But we all loved Mother's Milk, the album before it. And we're like, shit, they're going to be in Birmingham. It's only an hour away. Let's do it. So along we go. And they had a band called The Family Stand On First, who more of a kind of a soul thing, but they were terrific. But then they had the Rollins Band. Are you familiar with the Rollins Band? So Henry Rollins is like a punk mainstay is from a band called Black Flag. It's like seminal punk band in the US. And Rollins, this is his own band, and he just walks out on stage. Nobody else is on the stage. He just walks out on stage wearing just a pair of shorts and a lot of tattoos and a very angry glare.
Nice.
And he just stares out at the audience like, the fuck are you lot doing here? I'm like, okay, this is going to be interesting. And the band come out and he's still just standing there glaring at us. And then they launch into a song. They actually kicked off with a song called Liar from the album at the time, which was The End of Silence. And they were amazing. And if I'd been the Chili Peppers, I'd have been furious.
Well, sure, yeah.
Because the support band was stunningly, I mean, the Chili Peppers were really good, don't get me wrong, but the Rollins band was what I left thinking about.
Just thinking of talking about punk, did you read Sellout by Dan Ozzie?
No. But I know you told me about it before, though.
Yeah. So he's, it's kind of the, from 94 to 2007 or 8 or whatever. And basically each chapter follows one like punk band and kind of tells their story, either like A, of how they got set up, but then how they ended up selling out or not selling out to one of the major record labels and kind of how they handled the post thing. And it was just a really fun book to read. And then like some of the bands I knew, some of the bands I didn't know. And then it was like, what I would do is I'd find whatever their early stuff was on Spotify, and I would try and kind of match the background music to what I was reading just to get a feel. And it was kind of cool just doing that kind of together. It was a really, really fun book, really interesting.
It does sound pretty good. But we've talked quite a
lot. We have. Let's get on to our amazing guest, Mr. Lee.
I'll just cut Lee's interview right down, so he'll just do like 5 minutes on the end. Don't touch it. He'll be fine with that.
The PR team screaming. We waited how long for this?
Lee is about to join us, kind of. Fintan, nice to be back. I think that this might be our only episode this week, but we'll be back with
glad you're alive. That's just so. Thanks for coming back, John.
I'm glad too. This is Mike. Mike's boss asked him to find a new iGaming platform for the company's multi-million dollar new project. Mike found one, but it wasn't very good. In fact, it was shitty. Now Mike's partner has left him. He has no friends, and he recently caught crabs. Possibly from a dirty toilet seat. Don't be like Mike. Choose Sporting Tech. Sporting Tech, for all your iGaming platform needs. Other iGaming platforms are available. And we turn to our first guest of this shiny, shiny new format where we just probably have one guest on. I mean, unless they walk out, in which case we might get a second guest on. Hasn't happened yet, but it's only a matter of time. First guest, our only guest, superstar of the day, is who are you?
Good start. My name's Lee Nissim. I'm the chief exec and founder of Future Anthem.
So Lee, the burning, well, I've got two burning questions, which I'm going to kick off with. Where did Future Anthem get its name from?
Good question. So it was actually called something else when I first started the business.
What was it called?
I'm not sure I want to tell you that.
Go on.
It was called Neuron XT because I thought it'd be exactly right. And behind that, Neuron was obviously brain thing, and XT because like extra. I like small hatchback fast cars, so I kind of thought that would be quite cool. But foolishly, I didn't check the trademarks. So walking around ICE about 2 weeks before we were launching, I came across a stand and they had Neuron Gaming, and I checked them out and they had the trademarks. And so I can only describe it as the equivalent of like your pet dying. And so I was a bit thrown, quite significantly thrown actually. It took me 3 months to think of another name, and knowing my wife and friends, we're walking Lake District, they're firing names. I'm going, no. And I was actually at a gig, the Royal Albert Hall, a DJ I really like, David Rodigan, kind of 70-year-old DJ reggae style, and everyone just was listening to this track and they started singing. I was like, oh my God, this is like an anthem. I was like, oh, Anthem. Quite like that name. Anthem begins with A, big rousing, positive, communal. Everyone's got an anthem, different styles of anthem. It's like really liking that. But, you know, we're building these machine learning models and they're like anthems of the future. It's like, oh, quite like that, future anthem. So I kind of play with that a little bit. And then obviously you go and check out the domains, which domains are available, and all the domains were available, thank God. So I registered all the domains, and then it went from there, and our platform's called Anthemetrics. So there's kind of a nice, you know, flow through, and I didn't want to be a traditional data science business, you know, with pictures of men and women overlooking PCs in an office with glasses and pointing at screens. I wanted it to be more kind of contemporary, creative, you know, people creating with code. So yeah, Future Anthem's got quite a musical orientation and genesis, and that's the story of how the company came to be. Much better than Euronext, I think.
It's so much better than that. I can't even begin to tell you.
Thank you.
Because if you come on here and that was your name, I'd be saying, why have you got such a shit name?
it'd be 30 minutes of him just teasing you about the name. So this is much more pleasant for everyone.
Thank you for that.
I mean, I was going to, but now that, you know, in relative terms, it is so much better that I've got nothing. Are you excited about the new season of Cobra Kai?
I haven't actually watched too much of Cobra Kai.
Is there such a thing as too much Cobra Kai? But I'm not aware that there is.
You have to ask somebody else around that. So I don't think I've watched too much of it at all. I'm not actually watching that much TV at the moment. There's too much sport and football going on the TV, so it's full sports on all the time in my household when my wife's not watching some Danish detective serious thing, politics, God knows. So yeah.
What sports do you watch?
Football regularly, obviously. A fair amount of cricket. My kids love cricket. So there's cricket on all the time, some golf sometimes, and that's about the extent of the sport that is on my TV. But it's pretty much every football match that's on TV.
Do you follow a particular team?
I do. I follow Tottenham Hotspur as a team. It's not that bad.
Sorry, I thought my mic was off.
No, I could be a Liverpool supporter right now, or a Chelsea supporter. Like I say, it's not that bad. It's been worse for sure.
What are you saying exactly there?
Who do you support, you guys?
I call it soccer, which I think gives you exactly where my level is in this conversation.
Today, Fenton found out it was nothing to do with socks, honestly. You could hear the tears. I can't say I support, because I distanced myself from football a while ago when I realized it had just lost all touch with reality and community. But I follow the results of Chelsea Football Club.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's been a big week. It's been a big year.
Yeah. I find very interesting, very interesting club, because you know, they had so many good years, achieved so many good things, and then, you know, all those things almost came crashing down in a very challenging period of meeting Chelsea supporters last summer, and they're like, well, they can't stop us doing transfers, and it's outrageous. And you're like, well, you know, you have been funded for years to kind of achieve a lot of your success. So they all got very upset. And then God knows how they managed to negotiate a sale out of the government and actually conclude it on time. And like a year now, it's like any other company, the change it's going through is enormous. In that you look at it through the purchases over the summer and what's gone on with the manager. I couldn't believe it when they sacked Tuchel, right?
And any other business that was trying to navigate these hurdles would have just died on its ass. In the time period that we're talking about, it's incredible.
The government
just negotiating
the
sale in that time is extraordinary.
100%, 100%, with all the politics wrapped up in it as well. Very interesting. So I know idea where Chelsea will end up in it. We'll see.
I'm not what you would call a tribalistic football supporter. I have enormous respect for most teams. Note the use of the word most. But it's interesting, the criticisms of Chelsea and the way that the club has been funded, which I totally get. I'm not saying it's right, but it's also reality. So you can either accept it and just fucking swallow it, or you can just be bitter and angry and go and fuck yourself. And because football is so distanced from reality and community now, people don't have a choice about who buys the club. My favorite period for Chelsea was actually under Ken Bates. And let's not forget, Bates did one truly wonderful thing, and that was that he sold the pitch to the supporters so that the ground could never be sold for development.
Yeah.
And that's a glorious little move. But under Bates, when Hoddle and then Hullett and Vialli, and the team had so much character and they were so much fun to watch, and they would go toe-to-toe with everybody regardless of who they were or how much better than them they were. And that attitude, and I loved that. I absolutely just, yeah.
I think it's the same thing for sport generally at the moment, right? I think the amount of money coming through sport, you just have to watch what's going to happen with the golf tour, right? We talk about it a lot over dinner, right? You're just like, I mean, talking about ripping up a sport and good or bad thing, and everyone's got different views, but wow. You know, like, again, similarly, a friend of mine, you know, is quite involved in the World Cup. And he was telling me that, you know, there's only 50 hotels in Qatar, right? And there's 28 teams taking 28 hotels. There's really not that much accommodation. And again, you look at the money flowing through and the reasons behind the money flowing into sport. I don't think people really realize the kind of how it's changing and altering the dynamics of sport in such a fundamental way. So Chelsea Football Club, the Live Tour, whatever it might be, it's just like just big dynamic shifts going. It almost feels bigger than they've been for quite some time, actually, but we'll see.
It's all very annoying. Anyway, I think we can all agree on that. So Future Anthem, what'd you do?
We use AI to personalize player experiences, ideally in real time. So I just started the business because I could see when at Scientific Games and the IGT businesses that I've led, when roadmaps were being presented to me, how little, you know, our teams were using data to come up with, you know, the games we were building. We were spending $500,000 plus on R&D efforts to build games, and yeah, how those games are targeted at which types of players and how casino operators would run them, position them, promote them, all very unscientific without data. And, you know, these games produce a lot, you know, billions of spins that go through them. So the initial premise of the business was around using, you know, really high volume transactional data to understand player behaviors and really using that to try and predict how a player plays when they're in session. And once you can do that, you can recommend an action, whether it's a, you know, game recommendation, an award, or, you know, if they're playing with risk, you can understand what to recommend. So our system receives data in real time. We have machine learning models for different use cases. We make recommendations to the native system to take an action towards the consumer. So, yeah, and it's all about helping players have a better experience when they're gambling. And a more responsible experience, I should say. RG is a very important component within our model set.
I see. But, you know, I was just curious. Vince?
So I'm an entrepreneur and I love entrepreneurs. So as a founder, let's take a step back. So you're in the big corporate environment. You decided, right, screw this. I'm going to go out on my own. Walk me through that.
Kind of worked like that and didn't work like that. So I'm a little bit fortunate, and I've done big and small all the way through my career, my 26, 7-year career. But actually, it wasn't me sitting there thinking, screw that, I'm going to go and set up another business. Someone screwed me. So I was happily going along leading SG's digital business, and I got put on a year's gardening leave when we bought NYX. So I lost my position, and I had quite a lot of time to think about what I wanted to do next.
1 year gardening leave.
Yeah, man. My garden was amazing.
What did you do for a year? a lot of golf? Like what was
that? Well, it's really interesting. I term it as like you spend the first 3 months thinking coulda, shoulda, woulda, you know, what just happened, because it was a relatively short tenure. I was enjoying it. I was enjoying the team, the people. Everything was really good. The business was growing again. So, like, I had that whole turmoil of what happened. Then I spent the next 3 months kind of calming down and kind of starting to enjoy it and doing some nice stuff. And then I had 6 months to think about and plan future Anthem. And all the way through that, I had a lot of time.
Panic set in.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. And through that, you know, a month's holiday in Vietnam with my family over the summer, a lot of good golf, obviously. Well, not obviously, but got super fit, going to the gym 6 days a week. I was already going about four times. Helped my wife actually in her business, which is a very positive business, helping what it's called working mums and working dads and working wives for the over 50s. So they promote employer best practice for diversity and inclusion. And she'd been running that business for about 15 years. So just spent a bit of time helping her achieve most of the projects she never wanted to, systems upgrades and all that kind of stuff. It was an interesting year. I'd happily talk to anyone who's got a year on gardening leave. Everyone says, oh, it's amazing. I was like, well, it kind of was, you know, but we did so many nice things, but some other things that, you know, you end up a bit neutral on it, actually. But yeah, it was really good when I look back, and for scarce time. So anyway, that's how I came to founding Future Anthem. I built up quite a few bigger businesses and sold them at IGT. And we built some member up. We sold to GTEC. I'd done a startup in between in retail betting and lottery. And I just wanted to do something on my own. I didn't want to go into a bigger business that was slower. I could see the opportunity with data. My customers were managing their games, you know, not that well. So I've always had success doing things early, came to the internet in 99 from finance. And so I thought, what's early? Well, AI, data. Went and saw a few tried and trusted friends, Lee Fenton at Gamesys, Connor Grant at Sky, ran the idea by them, talked about it, and they really liked it. Lee Fenton, I'm going to give you three pieces of advice. And well, they just responsible gambling. Connor said, yeah, sounds brilliant. Then it was born. And then there's a whole story after that about how my team came together. Few employees from other businesses got made redundant. I picked them up, and then we built a platform and got a pilot client, and boom, 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 kind of went from there. But that's the genesis of Future Anthem.
That's fantastic. That's a good story. I like that.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's scary because it's difficult, right? It's a tricky, you know, building that team, getting the first client, getting the product right, getting stuff going. You've got a family. You know, there's a lot going on there.
There's a couple of interesting aspects you talk about there, right? Because sometimes I think, is it luck? Is it timing? Is it planning? And then you kind of figure out it's probably a mix of all three. And the family thing, like, this is two small businesses in our family, right? So, and my wife's business changed massively during COVID. That was about like the third cycle in 15 years. So, you know, and that was one of the decisions, you know, do I go and work with her in a family business, try and grow it, or do I start on my own or go work with another company? I look at there's certainly different, you know, through the 3 years we've been going, there's different periods of inflection points of things that have happened for a particular reason. Like early in my journey, I met a chief data officer through LinkedIn, right? So he was a contact of a contact. I saw him. He was at Rank, leaving Rank after 7 years running AI and data science and advanced analytics there. Met to meet him in Chiswick, 6'5", Glaswegian. And we had a chat. I'm leaving the sector. Well, can you help me come figure out, build a platform onshore or offshore? I'll come do some consultancy for you. So he did that. And then 3 months later, he really saw the opportunity, really liked it. Chris, do you want to come on board? I will do, but I'm going to go and live in Glasgow, not London. You know, I'm cool with that. And then, three years later, again, like, you know, he's been with us from the beginning, and we have now, you know, 15 data scientists and engineers in the team. Wow. That we've built up through a combination of intern programs. Contractors have become employees. And again, that's through my network, meeting Chris on my journey. What would have happened if I'd never met Chris on my journey in Chiswick for a coffee, you know? So,
but there must be more to, there must be something around company culture and stuff as well, because like those data scientists aren't, you know, their LinkedIn is getting hammered with job offers, right? So to attract and retain is must be a challenge too.
Well, Interesting. We were on this Tech Nation program, government sponsored for AI businesses, young AI businesses. And that's what most people are talking about. They talk about two things: growing, retaining staff, and dealing with your shareholders. And honestly, these are two things I don't have problems with. And so you sit there really proud and happy because we've never really been hit with that. So with the team, you know, why is that? Well, it's because data is our product. So it's not like this is a team that's marginalized, 5-6 people sitting in a corner like they are in many betting or gaming businesses, and they don't really get asked, and they spend their life trying to engineer data so they can actually do something with it. You know, we've built everything in the latest technologies. It's new. Our data's in great shape. We work in real time. So they're working in a really good environment to, you know, to develop their code. They get autonomy. They get responsibility. They run projects. And, you know, we bring in a minimum of 3 interns every quarter, and the good ones we extend. And then if they're still good, then we make them employees. And if they're employees, then we give them rapid acceleration and progression. And now they're managing teams and pods, you know, the first ones that were with us, you know, came. So it doesn't always have to be that way. And you have to try and stay competitive, obviously, financially with the market. But if you create that environment that they can succeed in, then yeah, we have managed to have really good retention. And also the responsible gambling thing is an important component, because, you know, gambling, don't want to be in gambling. But when you explain it, our models and what they do and how cutting edge these models are, they understand the opportunity is very balanced and about sustainability. And there's a lot of data in the gambling sector, right? So there's a lot to go after. Right. And it's sports, you know, as well as casinos. So it's quite contemporary. It's not like, again, financial services, I'm building some fintech products no one's heard of to try and do this micro behavioral thing in some Far Eastern market. You know, this is dealing with, you know, Ladbrokes and 888 and these fantastic global brands. So, you know, it's good. It's good for the team.
That's fantastic. So the product itself, obviously we got the elevator pitch. So it's if we take things like messaging and rewards and stuff like that. So the system's looking at user behavior, profiling the user, and then making a recommendation as to what to do next, or like you said, like a game recommendation or something. How do you, so I've kind of 2 questions, and they're about like opposite ends of the spectrum. So one is like data in is kind of obviously one big area. And then as a marketing nerd, I'm really curious on things like, does somebody have to sit there and write 500 different variations of a message or a recommendation or something for the, you know, so just kind of like the really kind of practical kind of nuts and bolts. So if we take the input in stuff, like how do you ingest the data, like if we take say game recommendations, so like how do you profile all the games to be able to know which ones match for the users?
Sure.
How does that work?
Yeah, let's just break this down a little. So the first thing is getting data in, which is both easy and hard in the same breath. So easy in that slots data is quite consistent, and so is betting transactional data. It's all anonymized transactional data, player ID, bet ID, time of day, you know, it's amount staked, amount won, amount lost, all those good things. And we ingest into our platform within like 48, 72 hours if we want. And we're talking billions of transactions. So in Real Money Casino, we processed about 60 billion transactions. In Social Casino, about 140 billion transactions. And we're actually just starting to ingest sports transactions as we've moved into sports betting. So the platform's set up to do that. We have a very competent team of data engineers. That's in quotes the easy part. The hard part is asking people to send us their data. Some companies are very private. Some people companies are very sensitive, obviously, to their own IP. And it's been really interesting because the casino environment, which is how we set the business up, I call quite a closed data ecosystem, because it's all locked up behind closed doors, right? And it's like, well, why do you want it? Whereas on the sports side, where we're doing more work, the whole business is built on data. And so actually it's much more of an open ecosystem. So there's a much more lean-in approach, like, what can I give you and what can you do with it? So that's the data in, easy and hard in the same breath. And then our platform's built really well. It's a great technology, all in Microsoft Azure. So our models are consistent. They run across the, we train them across the data. The models are producing results in, you know, a couple of weeks. So again, we run it because they're consistent game recommendation or churn prediction or LTV prediction or risk scoring for, you know, responsible gambling, whatever it might be. So we're producing results now. And in the instance you asked, game recommendation, there's kind of three core pillars of our product. One is called collaborative filtering, so journeys. So how do you map journeys of consumers and follow the same path? So if you pay, you know, one Red Tiger game, what's your most likely next Blueprint game or your next likely IGT game? But those engines can get a bit biased because they're just based on popularity. So you, it's like vicious cycle of just, you just promoting the same games. What we have, which we've built exclusively for the casino industry, is we've built proprietary metadata on like 20,000 games. So we've normalized volatility, profit rates, hit rates, default stake, themes, colors of all of these games that we've seen in our platform, both data we've built from seeing all the transactional patterns and data we've sourced publicly from third-party sites. So we combine all that metadata together.
Has somebody had to sit there and just like type in, it is a red game, or like, how does that work? How do you?
Well, they build models. They build models that basically we go and collect all this metadata from suppliers' websites, from affiliate websites, and try and understand dates the games were launched or the theme name of a game and whether it's got a pirate theme or it's got a genie theme, and are we then creating the same theme if it's pirates and genie? There's lots of thought that goes into that. So I know that it's all based on algorithms and models, and the financial information around the games, like the pay distribution, that's all built again through models. So no one's doing any kind of coding. We just couldn't deal with the doing any kind of manual input because they can't really. I mean, like, again, the team, they built sentiment analysis looking at slots on affiliate sites. You know, again, that was through like one of our hack days. They built it on the hack day. We commercialized it to a robust product we can put out in 72 hours. Now we've got sentiment analysis that we're running across a few different sites trying to understand how people are talking about slots. And that's the kind of thing we build into our recommendation engine, whether people are talking about them positively or negatively. So again, that metadata is the second core pillar. The third pillar is some rules around commercial rules. You know, these games are cheaper, so I want to promote them more. These games are, you know, made a deal with the supplier, so I've got to give these overages. So there's a few overrides that come through, and that's the essence, and that's all of what we build in the models. And then the third thing that you asked about is like the messaging. So Future Anthem is like the brain, the AI. So we're just sending triggers and files in real time or batch, however often the system can. On the operator side or the game studio side can take it. So we're powering those front end technologies. So it depends what your messaging technology is, but it can be, again, player ID, game ID, free spins amount. Here's their preferred game 1, 2, 3, 4. Can be up to 20 games that we might recommend. So it's all automated and runs in, you know, as a daily process, as a real time process.
Nice. And then, so whatever the front end engine is, it takes this in as inputs and then it can trigger whatever happens.
Yeah, exactly. So on the casino side, which is, again, find hugely fascinating, is many operators and suppliers have kind of free spins engines that accept automated triggers. So, you know, we can send our triggers into those engines and they just fire off. So again, if you're sitting in a Blueprint game, we can send a trigger. The game reacts and awards a free spin, and it's all seamless to the consumer experience when they're sitting in that game. You wouldn't even know that, you know, we're sitting in the background, but we are, because we might be polling real-time RTP to understand whether the player's having a good or a bad experience, because people don't really realize. Yeah, people don't really realize, like, you know, 60%, 70% of consumers have an RTP of less than 60%. And that's because they're only spinning 15, 20 spins. They're not getting the value from the game. So when they're getting RTP levels like that, it's a bad experience. They're going to leave. They're going to churn. So it's only really the top percentage of players who wager that get the true 95, 94% RTPs. So, you know, the vast majority of players are actually having, you know, not a great play experience. So RTP is very important aspect of churn and retention and understanding behaviors. And in the same vein, you traditionally operators look at value segments, say, well, that's a high value player or a medium value player, but one medium value player might only play one game, another one might play 15 games. They're very different play styles than the value segment would, give them, attribute to them. So why give free spins to a consumer that's loyal to one game? Or if you're going to give him free spins, give it to him on that game, not on 15 other games he won't play, so we'll stick on. So there's a lot behind the AI and the intelligence to come up with those recommendations.
Got it. And then I suppose that then the operator needs to obviously then do something with it, right? So correct. The data's there, it's accessible, and then they need to work with your data to
correct intervene.
Trigger the, here's the email, here's the text message, here's the notification for a VIP team to make a call.
Correct.
Or whatever it's going to be. Okay, cool. Correct. That's correct. Really good. That's
yeah, really and good. Just, importantly on that is like responsible gambling. Because when we set the business up, we knew we couldn't just be a machine just to try and monetize. So we do RGE checks as well on consumers. So we're looking at how consumers' session is playing out. Are they erratic? Is the intensity going up? The frequency going up? And if we're noting signs of problematic play, we score every game session. So again, we supply that with our recommendations. So it's like an early warning system. This guy is changing. All of a sudden he's betting every Tuesday. Now he's betting every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and his stake is going up. And they're very good models for picking up players who've got risk. So that again is working also in the background behind all of this predictive AI.
Very good. And what does integration then look like? So from an operator, so you talked about, like, obviously some operators are reluctant to share information. My guess is the ones who are reluctant probably can't, but that's a different story. How much, I know it's a how long's a piece of string, but what does a typical integration look like?
It can vary, and it really depends on what platform you're sitting on. So there's some very good platforms like the Playtech platform, interestingly. Lots of functionality to create bonusing at a player level. Likewise, there's some email and push vendors, a lot more open, just we can send the triggers in, automated them. Everything really happens. Others, can't change their lobbies, and it's a lot harder for them to kind of make a game recommendation. But they can publish an interstitial if you use another technology. So there's definitely some intricacy there for sure. But I think most operators are realizing the next phase of the industry is in real time, and the KPIs say it. When we work in real time, they're like 4x better than when you work in batch or daily, right? Because you're hitting someone in the session. So it really depends on what machinery is available inside the operators and what we can get access to. But so data in's quick, modeling's quick. The implementation can take a little bit longer, anywhere from 4 to 12 weeks, for example. And then you're in the whole A/B testing. Well, okay, let's test the difference of these interventions versus no intervention or this recommendation and at player level. And it's not necessarily on spends. It can be on session length. It can be on conversion, many different things that you want to track. And again, you're back to the DNA of the business. Am I here to monetize? Am I here to increase retention? What am I here to do? And that's, again, you see different operators having different outlooks and approaches on what they want to achieve. And that can also vary by market. Whether it's a regulated market, an unregulated market, or whether a sports business first or a casino first business. So there's quite a lot of differences when you work across the terrain. Sportsbooks are very interesting because obviously casino is often the second product, even though it's a high monetization product and a lot of focus on sports. So casino teams often under-resourced. But they always want to do more, and there's lots of data to go after. And how do sports consumers differ from direct casino players? And interesting for Future Anthem, that's another part of our journey. So we were casino first, but now we're doing sports as well. We've been working in sports for about 4 months now. We signed a lead client, and it's going very well for bet recommendation. Same thing, behavioral profiling. Does this guy bet every Saturday? Was he bet on? How can you target bets, bet recommendation, churn predict? Same problematics, but different data set. And I thought everyone would be really sophisticated on that stuff in sports, and turns out not, because they've got, again, the same complexities of moving their lobby around or their bet slips, and they've got other priorities to launch in another market or another regulatory pressure. It's very consistent with what we've seen in casino. But yeah, again, like lots to go after in the gambling industry, and feels like that's a very fantastic. Good time.
Yeah, that sounds good. Like perfect timing. Well done. Well done.
Thank you. That comes back down to the luck, planning, and timing, right? Which one of those things is it? You know, who knows?
It's all three. I've definitely had some instances where timing was just like perfect. Yes. It does make the difference. And I think what was interesting as well, you're talking about, you know, everything's moving to real time, right? So that's where it's going. And when you explain what you guys do at Future Anthem, you're kind of like, yeah, if you don't have this, your competitors are just going to eat your lunch, because customers are just going to have a much better all-round, you know, including the RG and all this kind of stuff. They're just going to have a much better all-round experience, because if you could, like, intervening with customers who are having a bad session, like that, you know, increases the probability that they come back.
100%.
If you can make that session not as bad, and they mightn't even be able to explain why they're coming back, or if they go somewhere else, like, oh, I don't like it here, I'm going to go back to whatever brand. It does make a lot of sense. And it's kind of one of these things now that you see it work and you're like, yeah, everyone should do this. And
yeah,
sooner.
Well, I think there's a couple of different things around that. I mean, one is just on that use case specifically. Yeah, the industry spends so much on acquiring new players. And so they work so hard on bringing players through the door. They don't often work as hard on like that conversion and retention. And particularly when you see like the RTPs of these customers. So, you know, these games are built not necessarily to give a great RTP experience, and, you know, you churn. So you got this player in and it's cost you, you know, 100, 200 quid to get them in, and, you know, they leave within, you know, a handful of sessions, if not earlier. So, you know, you do need to intervene and be able to understand that and react to that and try and improve, how the experience that a customer has with you. And the real-time thing is, again, like I set the business up naively thinking everyone would be working in real-time. It turns out like 2 out of 10 are, right? You know, and everyone has an aspiration to get there. And when you understand why, it makes sense. It's because, again, legacy systems in casino, hugely fragmented, 50 game suppliers, billions of transactions. I got a Playtech platform, and I got a Relax platform, and I got an SG thing, and I got, like, you know, it's like spaghetti. And it's built up because I want to launch new games. That's how I make money, and that's how I grow. And I've had that, you know, so good for so long, and now I've got 3,000 games. Jesus, well, how do I get 3,000 games on the front page of my mobile phone? And what do I present? They all look the same, and they don't. Some take your money in, you know, 30, 40 seconds, and some give you 4 or 5 minute gaming experience. And they're very different propositions for a new player, a casino experienced player. And so, you know, kind of giving that game to the right player quickly is fundamentally important to the retention journey. So it's understandable why the industry is where it is. And I was in Gibraltar this week, and one or two meetings, it amazed me how people are talking about real time now in a way they never were a year ago or even a year before that. It's almost like the industry is all realizing at once that actually it is about real time and they need to get there, and how can they get there?
But this is the gambling industry all over. It takes one hero to try something different and make it work. And then everybody's will copy, like when, I don't know, Cash Out came out or what, pick a product, right? It's like, oh my God, of course we need this. And then everybody will just completely change their roadmap to copy it immediately. So
the industry is
really, really good at copying good ideas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also,
Once it's available, right? I think that's but it's also the strength, because the industry will change very quickly. 100%.
So I look at Cash Out, because I hate it when people say the industry doesn't innovate, because it does really well. So whether it was when Uega came in and 888 and Party reinvented their businesses within a year, like they had to innovate, or whether it's Live Dealer that wasn't even a category in 2010, you know, whatever. And now Evolution, one of the biggest gambling companies, you know, globally. or cash out, like you mentioned, or AI, like we're doing. The industry consistently innovates, and I think one of the reasons and the challenges it doesn't is because it's always complying with regulations, and that's a significant burden. So again, it's not like the music industry that can do it a lot quicker. Like if you're Spotify, you don't necessarily have some of those complexities that high volume international global e-commerce systems with financial services like gambling industry is, the complexities that brings. So I think it actually does a very good job in its own, you know, it might not feel like it, but it does to innovate. And the pressures are coming externally because, Jesus, like, you know, I get off the plane at Gatwick and why is there no Bolts here within, you know, 3 minutes, or Uber's here in 3 minutes to take me home, you know, at one in the morning, you know, I want that experience like now. And so I think, you know, Spotify, Uber's, Bolts, they are driving this desire for, you know, real-time personalization. Obviously, everyone talks about Netflix, but Amazon, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So I think that, you know, that there's as much external pressure to take that shift as there is on the gambling industry itself.
Well, that's nice. but we have to cut it short there, I'm afraid, gentlemen, because we're out of time, because this is our new short episode format.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I've been short enough for you guys.
No, you've been perfect. We're doing our own A/B testing right now, trying short format versus long format. But Lee, look, thanks so much for this. This is brilliant. Everyone should go buy Future Anthem. That's obvious. Lee's a great guy, and thanks for coming on.
So shameless plug, but you know, futureanthem.com. I'm lee.nissimat at Future Anthem, and you know, we love to have conversations with companies at different stages of their journey. So please get in contact. It'd be great.
And you probably find them on LinkedIn and all that as well.
Yeah, for sure. We're there too. Well, really nice to speak to you both on a Friday afternoon, smiling, and thanks for the opportunity. Very much appreciated.